The second case for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Larry Richter. It's appeal number 30804. Nicole Laughlin is here, will be arguing on behalf of defendant appellant, and Angela Shute will be arguing, assistant attorney general will be arguing on behalf of the state. Ms. Laughlin, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. I'd like to start with just a brief recitation of the facts in this case because the facts are very important here. On July 3rd, 2021, Larry Richter held a 4th of July party at his home. He invited several people to the party. There was also a party next door. Between the two combined parties, there were about 50 people. He invited his backyard neighbor. They actually had adjoining backyards, and that neighbor had a girlfriend with a 19-year-old developmentally disabled son. That son became the alleged victim in this case. At the time of the party, he was 19 years old. By the time we get to trial, he was 21 years old. That's also important. We do not have any dispute that he is developmentally delayed. He has cognitive function at the level of a 7-year-old. He has significant issues that are documented over his lifetime with memory problems, processing problems, and an inability to retain information. He is unable to work, and mom has guardian and conservatorship of him. On July 4th, 2025, the day after the party, my client, Larry Richter, goes to a different party. On July 5th, he goes to work. That night, he starts getting text messages and phone calls from the mother of the alleged victim saying, "You touched my son. I know you touched my son. I have a tracker on him. I know you did it." There are three alleged incidents of touching of the testicle of the alleged victim, two over the clothing, one under the clothing. These can be boiled down into three different incidents. The first incidents would be once on a four-wheeler, once while sitting on top of a covered hot tub, and once near a trailer in Richter's backyard. I understand that the court is going to have a lot of questions probably about issue one and that we will spend a lot of time there, but it's important in this case to go through the recitation of the facts and then start with the sufficiency of the evidence claim, because it is a problem here that we never get a clearly established record of what exactly happened, in what order, how it happened, where it happened, when it happened. We do know, though.
So isn't that really, aren't you really asking us to reweigh the evidence, like a credibility? You know, we've got a young man who apparently has some deficits. Aren't you really asking us to sit in the place of the jurors and reweigh this evidence? We've got to step back and say, is there any evidence is the evidence so lacking in this record, state failed to prove one of their elements? And if so, what is that?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the state has failed to prove the element that there was sexual contact here, because the touching, which is the crime, the only element that's out there is whether the touching occurred. The only evidence we have for that is the victim's or alleged victim's statement, and we never have a clear, coherent.
Not exactly right. I mean, there's admissions, right? The client admitted on a phone call, said, "Yeah, I mean, I touched him in those three instances." And in context, could the jury have not concluded, well, that's a pretty compelling admission?
Well, my client testified. I wasn't trial counsel, but he did testify at the trial. And he explained that those were not admissions, that those were taken out of context.
And that was his self-serving testimony, or so the jury could conclude. They could reject that, and they could say, no, when you are on the phone, this is exactly in context what you meant. And so, of the issues, though, that you've got, and I know you've got a couple of them, what's the best one? Why do you think you win?
Well, I think that the sufficiency of the evidence is important because we're going to be looking at issue one, issue two, and issue three. All are going to have this court make a prejudice analysis. And the prejudice analysis has to be weighed against the strength of the evidence, because was there a possibility there could have been a different result in this case?
But you have to prove, before you get to that assessment, you have to prove there's some error somewhere. You have to prove that there's a basis for getting to that point. What among those issues?
Absolutely. Well, Your Honor, issue one, whether the trial court abused its discretion by allowing the victim to have a stuffed animal while testifying, is absolutely the strongest case for error in this case.
The comfort animal issue? Which one? I'm sorry?
Issue one. In the brief, the stuffed animal.
Yeah,
the abuse of discretion. So in this case, the trial court allowed the alleged victim, who was 21 years old at the time, to testify while holding an 18-inch stuffed monkey. Judges, of course, have broad discretion in what they can allow as far as witness accommodation in the courtroom, but they always have to balance that with the potential prejudice that's going to be inflicted upon the defendant.
And the judge did that. The judge specifically said, I made a ruling about the amount of prejudice that he thought that would result from that.
Yes, and we are arguing that was absolutely outside of the scope of permissible things that he could have decided in this case based on the very clear statutory law that's in place right now.
But it's not that the judge didn't make the proper assessment. It's that you disagree with the assessment that he made, or you, more correctly, your argument, as I understand it, is that the legislature passed a statute that specifically said, courts, you can let young children have comfort things like this when they're testifying, and the effect of that was that it prohibits courts from doing it for other people like developmentally disabled.
Both.
If that's your argument, that the court lacked authority?
Both.
Well, if they lacked authority, that's almost more de novo. I mean, if they lacked any authority, and the rule is under no circumstances that someone who is not a child could have a stuffed animal, if that's what it is, then you know, that may not be entitled to as much deference as an abuse of discretion determination. But I'll hear your argument on that.
Well, Your Honor, we would find that the finding of the court, to go back to Justice Myron's question, was lacking. When you look at the questioning that took place before, first of all, there's an email that's not in the record where the court says that he's inclined to grant it without hearing anything from the alleged victim. Then there is a very short questioning before the alleged victim takes the stand where the judge says, are you nervous to testify? He says, kind of. Okay, will this help you calm down? Yeah. Okay, and then we let it in.
So I'm a little confused, because I understood from your briefs that your argument was that this was not within the authority of the court to do.
Both.
Okay.
Yes.
So.
Both and.
Assuming you're incorrect on that, the court has the authority. You're also making an argument that the court didn't properly exercise whatever discretion that it had.
Well, I'm saying here that the court didn't have the authority to go beyond the statutory limitations on who is eligible to use a comfort item.
Although you started your argument, it seemed like, with a concession that the court has broad authority as to what types of accommodations can be made to witnesses.
Typically.
So how the fact that the legislature hasn't specifically referred to a scenario here where you have an adult with some disabilities that, according to the record, placed him in a category of a young child with respect to cognitive abilities and that sort of thing. So what is the law or the rule out there that would suggest a court is precluded from applying accommodation that is not within the specific confines of an existing statute, if there is such broad authority
Yes, thank you, Justice. And I believe that I was starting to explain that they have broad authority typically, but not in a situation like this where we have the clear statutory authority. So it is an abuse of discretion. It is beyond the reasonable choices the court could have made. I would also note that every single case that the state cites in its brief to support the notion that there's broad authority to allow witness accommodation in South Dakota is a child witness case.
But what's the source of the authority? So is it the idea that because the legislature has acted and sought to authorize or regulate that sort of you know, witness presentation for children witnesses, that the absence of any corresponding rule for adults or people who are not children means that the court cannot do it, has zero authority to do this at all? Is that the argument?
Yes, but it's outside of the reasonable choices because of the statute.
Well, but it would be outside. It would be there's just like no authority. If that's the argument, it's not even a question of reasonableness or not reasonable. It's a question of whether you can do it or not. And so it seems like the argument is that there's a rule by negative implication that because the court has authorized it in one area but not in this area, then the court has absolutely no authority to even consider doing something like this. Is that right? Is that fair?
Well, what's interesting in this case is that the statutes do allow for the developmentally disabled adult or child to have a therapy dog and have included them there. So it appears that the statutes have contemplated the difference.
But this wasn't a therapy dog.
No.
So back to my question. So is that your argument? Is it this negative implication that because they've legislated and regulated in other areas, the legislature that is, and the absence of any authority that would expressly permit this means the court has zero authority to do it?
In this case, yes.
And what about
Well, but in all cases, right? Not just this case. In all cases. The authority doesn't exist. That has to be true, correct?
Well, I would assert that, you know, if you take away the developmental disability and we're looking at the exact same item, if we're looking at having a witness bring in a stuffed animal, yes, I think that the court is prohibited. I mean, the statute doesn't say that an adult can't bring a stuffed animal with them into the courtroom and testify. And certainly, I think this court would be hard-pressed and this audience today would be hard-pressed to say that if I brought an 18-inch stuffed animal in here, set it on my desk or was holding it and never said a word about it, it would be the proverbial elephant in the room. It would probably lead you to question my judgment and competence as an attorney and leave you with some pretty big questions. And that's what we're arguing, that that's what it did to the jury. But in this case, it went further because it elicited sympathy from the jury. And it gave them the impression that my client was so scary because he had perpetrated these crimes that this alleged victim couldn't face him without this stuffed monkey. And that's the prejudice here. And that's why in this case, yes, it was abuse of discretion.
But that's the effect. Yeah, but that's the effect of it. That's the prejudice of it. I'm still trying to figure out whether, you know, if it's discretionary or whether it's an absolute bar. You know, there's an additional rule that is included among the rules in the briefs that the trial judge does have discretion, at least as a general matter, in terms of regulating the mode and the manner of the presentation of evidence, including the testimony from the witnesses. Why wouldn't that rule provide the judge with some authority to do, at least as a matter of discretion, what the judge did here?
Well, I believe the court is referring to Aldani, and that case specifically dealt with a child witness. And there is a lot of precedent for child witnesses. There is a lot of precedent for therapy dogs. There is no precedent in South Dakota for an adult testifying with a stuffed animal.
The rule is broader. The rule about regulating the mode and manner of presentation of witnesses and evidence is broader than children.
The rule also carries a balancing test of prejudice. And in this case, we are arguing that the prejudice outweighed any possible benefit. So it still fails. And then when you put that prejudice together with the prejudice of Dr. Free's testimony that this person was more likely to be a victim because of their status as a developmentally disabled person, that allowed the jury to take the alleged victim out of the realm of the public and put it in a smaller circle of people more likely to be abused, ergo more likely this happened. We also had the prosecutor in this case insinuating, inferring, stating that my client should have shown up with evidence of his innocence, which is totally
improper. Those are issues 2 and 3 in your brief. You agree that those issues weren't preserved at trial, so we're reviewing those both those issues for plain error?
I was not trial counsel, and there was no objection made. So I would assert that they are plain error, Your Honor. I think that when you're looking at the improper insinuation or the burden shifting by the prosecutor, it's possible the court could get to de novo if you're looking at whether the fundamental right to due process was violated.
So on both of those issues, not preserved, we've got to find not just error, but we've got to find that it should have been obvious to the court that it was error, and the court should have essentially jumped in and said, wait a second, you can't do that.
Correct. It needs to be error that's plain, affecting the substantial right that seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or the public reputation of the judicial proceedings. There's direct case law on point as far as Dr. Free's testimony, State v. Buchholz. In that case, the doctor was allowed to testify that the doctor gave a diagnosis of child sexual abuse, and the court said, no, you cannot invade the province of the fact finder like that. Here, we also have Dr. Free invading the province of the fact finder, and my time has concluded, so the appellant respectfully requests this court vacate the conviction and remand to the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hewitt, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. Larry Richter was properly convicted of 3 counts of sexual contact with a developmentally disabled adult, and any error or prejudice in the proceedings that he now claims have no merit. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in allowing DW to have a stuffed animal, a monkey named Ish, with him on the stand while he was testifying. The trial court properly utilized its well-established discretion to control the courtroom, including the mode and manner of witness testimony, and conducted the balancing test set out by this court in State versus Aladani.
The court had the authority to do it legally as a matter of discretion, in your view?
Yes, Your Honor.
No legal prohibition that would prevent the judge from doing what he did, notwithstanding an argument that maybe it was an improper exercise of discretion. There's no legal prohibition that prevents the judge from doing this.
That is the state's position, Your Honor.
And you don't think there's any negative implication from the fact that the legislature passed a statute that specifically authorized this type of assistance during juvenile testimony?
Yes. So the statutes that were cited by Mr. Richter in his argument that there's no legal authority to allow DW to have the stuffed animal, he cited 26-8A31.1 is the one that allows child witnesses to have a comfort item, such as a stuffed animal, with them while testifying. And the other one, 23A24.10, allows both child witnesses and those with developmental disabilities to have a comfort dog with them. It's the state's position that these statutes were enacted after this court's holding in Aladani, and they're merely a codification of the trial court's inherent authority to control its courtroom in these specific instances set out in the statute. And just because the legislature codified the use of a comfort item for child witnesses under that statute, it didn't take away the court's inherent authority to allow for accommodations for witnesses in other situations.
So it appears that your opposing counsel's perhaps more well-grounded argument in the law is the argument that, well, even if the court had that discretion, there was a prejudice resulting from that substantially outweighed that. So can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, DW is no different than the child witness that was involved in Aladani. He's a developmentally disabled adult. He functioned at the level of a 7-year-old. That was the testimony provided to the court. And the court, in having the discretion to allow him to hold the stuffed animal, found that it would not prejudice Richter. Richter does argue that the jury was left to conclude that because DW was allowed to have the stuffed animal, it gave the impression to the jury that he was so traumatized by this crime, it must have happened, and the only way that he could have needed this was because this happened to him. But again, the evidence before the jury showed that he was a developmentally disabled adult, functioned at the level of a seven-year-old, and the jury could reasonably conclude, based on his testimony, that having the stuffed animal with him calmed his anxiety, that he was suffering from anxiety from having to testify. Jurors do not leave their common sense at the door and can recognize that an alleged victim in any case, whether a child or an adult or anyone, they're in a vulnerable situation. And the jury was in the best position to judge the credibility of DW as well as Richter's credibility when he testified, the other witnesses who testified, and Richter's failed to show that the mere presence of the stuffed animal had any effect on the verdict.
So the stuffed animal is, so let's put that off to the side for a second, because the testimony is still going to feature evidence and sort of the background story for DW.
Yes.
Animal or not, right?
Yes.
So the jury will have an idea of who he is and you know how life is for him. But the animal's pretty strong. I mean, you know, from the defense perspective, that their perspective is, you know, that this really is an indicator to the jury that everything they're describing, the state through its evidence about vulnerability, is by virtue of the judge's authorization, confirmed. And we have a very vulnerable, sympathetic victim here. And that's pretty prejudicial, perhaps, or so they think. Your thoughts on that?
DW was able to testify very clearly about the incidents that occurred. And I think that shows that the court did its job, that it made the environment comfortable for him so that he was able to get out and tell the story. There may have been some issues with his memory as to the order of the events, you know, what date they actually occurred. But when he was testifying about the three incidents, he was very clear on the four-wheeler, this is what happened. On the hot tub, this is what happened. And behind the trailer, this is what happened. And I think the fact that he was able to do that and be subject to full cross-examination by Richter, who was able to question him about the order of events when he said this one happened first, which was inconsistent with what he had previously testified to. But it shows that this decision by the trial court was proper, that they accommodated DW in a way that allowed him to get up to fully testify, be subject to full cross-examination. He was comfortable, and it had minimal impact on Richter.
Can you please address the issue regarding Dr. Free's testimony? She testified regarding the vulnerabilities of developmentally disabled people to sexual abuse. Did the court err in permitting that testimony, and if have to be plain error? And if so, does that warrant reversal?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that the court erred and that warrants reversal. So Dr. Free kind of testified in a dual capacity at trial. She did give very brief, minimal testimony. I believe it was about half a page out of 14 pages of testimony, where she did say that people with developmental disabilities are more vulnerable to being sexually abused. She then went on to testify about her interactions with DW, her review of his medical records, and her observations of him for the basis of his having a developmental disability. The general testimony that she gave does comply with the parameters set out by this court in Buchholz and State v. Johnson. In Buchholz, this court stated that in child sexual abuse cases, a qualified expert can inform the jury of characteristics in sexually abused children and describe the characteristics the child exhibits. However, the expert cannot opine whether the sexual abuse actually occurred. And that's what happened here. Dr. Freed never made any sort of opinion as to whether DW himself was more vulnerable to being sexually abused or whether he was in fact sexually abused. She just gave that very general testimony that developmentally disabled people may be more vulnerable, and then went on to describe her interactions with DW.
Well, and I'm not sure if we have this argument or not, but why is the testimony individuals with increased individuals with disability have an increased vulnerability to all types of maltreatment, including sex abuse. Why is that not bolstering testimony?
It's similar to the testimony that was allowed by this court, Buchholz, and that describing characteristics of sexual abuse victims. And this court has upheld that in other instances as well. The expert in Buchholz went too far in making that diagnosis of child sexual abuse, which the court found did invade the province of the jury. That was not present in this case.
So the comment really is that they're at greater risk of vulnerability. I mean, that's reflected in public policy all over the statutes. Vulnerable individuals are protected in a different way. Under the rape statutes, under the sexual contact statutes, people who can't consent because of the vulnerabilities that they face, they're treated differently in public policy throughout our statutes.
Correct, Your Honor.
So I don't even know. I mean, this seems like an expression of public policy as much as anything else. I mean, or something that's if not public policy, self-evident and represented in public policy. People who are vulnerable are at greater risk of being abused.
Yeah. And, I mean, if this court looks at it under the plain error review and whether there was prejudice, the state believes that there was not, because there was sufficient evidence of the events from DW, as well as the admissions from Richter, to support the jury's verdict. And again, the jury was in the best position to weigh the credibility of the witnesses. They had the opportunity to observe DW, watch him testify, and make that determination as to whether the state met the elements of the offense based on the evidence presented to them.
How about the prosecutor's cross-examination?
Yes, Your
Honor. Mr. Richter.
Issue number 3.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any thing that would suggest error there, either under, evidentiary error, I think what the argument is driving at is the due process error that would be attendant to a prosecutorial misconduct allegation.
Yes, and the state does not believe that there was prosecutorial misconduct or a violation of Richter's due process rights. Richter made very specific admissions to DW's mother about the 3 incidents, and those were consistent with what DW originally had reported and then testified to at trial. But when Richter testified at trial, his story was basically, I only said these things because I was repeating back what DW's mother said he did. Not what he said he did, what she said he did. So the state cross-examined Richter at length about this testimony and first questioned him about those specific statements, read the statements back to him, and then asked, and you're telling us today for the first time that you said these things because Tracy was bothering you, right? The state then asked the questions that he now challenges to show the inconsistencies between his very specific admissions and this testimony at trial that these were essentially false admissions. The state was allowed to inquire about this far-fetched story that Richter came up with for trial in order to challenge his credibility.
Why could they do that? Well, what authorized that?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Why could they do that?
Because it was the story that he gave at trial was that he essentially did not make these admissions.
But he was testifying.
He was testifying, Your
Honor.
He
didn't have to testify.
Correct.
But he elected to testify.
He did. And the state was allowed to cross-examine him on the testimony that he gave. And the state agrees that the burden of proof in every criminal case is on the state to prove all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. That's on the state. The jury was properly instructed on that burden of proof several times. Instruction number 2 that was given prior to jury selection, instruction number 14, and instruction number 15 all set out that the state has the burden of proof. And the state reiterated that in its closing argument, that it had the burden of proof. The state did not use his silence to law enforcement as any evidence of his guilt. Rather, the state questioned the story that he gave for the first time at trial to show its inconsistency with what DW originally reported and then testified to. The state also implored the jurors to use their common sense when assessing Richter's credibility in light of the admissions that the jury heard and his testimony at trial. So there was no error or prejudice to Richter resulting from the prosecutors questioning him about his admissions and then arguing about his credibility.
The remaining issue that you haven't addressed involves the sufficiency of the evidence question. Would you like to address that, please?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court didn't, so at trial, Richter moved for a judgment of acquittal three times, and each time the trial court denied it. That goes to the sufficiency of the evidence. So to obtain a conviction for any of the counts, the state had to prove that Richter knowingly engaged in sexual contact with DW, that Richter was 15 years of age or older, DW was 16 years of age or older, and DW was incapable of consenting because of his mental or physical incapacity. And it appears that Richter's only challenging whether there was sexual contact. Sexual contact is defined under SDCL 2222.7.1 as any touching not amounting to rape, whether or not through the clothing or other covering of the breasts of a female or the genitalia or anus of any person with the intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of either party. So DW testified about the three specific incidents where Richter placed his hand on DW's genitals, over his clothing when they were on the four-wheeler, over his clothing when they were sitting on the hot tub, and under his clothing when they were behind the trailer. DW also testified that he told Richter to stop touching him several times, and the repeated contact, despite being told to stop, supports the jury's finding that this was not accidental touching. It was done with the intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of either party. And Richter's admissions to the three incidents where he made statements such as, I was just getting to know him. I wasn't trying to have sex with him or nothing. I know I took it too far. I didn't mean to hurt him. I didn't mean to scare him. I was drinking and having a happy time, you know, enjoying himself, I believe supports the jury's finding of those, that those elements were met as well. There's no further questions. The state would request that this court affirm the conviction.
Thank you. Ms. Laughlin, you may proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Since we left off with the sufficiency of the evidence, I would like to start there. The state says that, well, the monkey worked, right? We gave him the stuffed monkey, and he was able to tell this story beginning, middle, end. He testified to all of these incidents, and it calmed him such that we could get that cohesive statement. That statement was not cohesive, which is important because it's all the evidence we have. We don't have physical evidence. The only evidence we have of touching with the intent to sexually gratify is the statement of DW. My client's admission, or what's being characterized as an admission today, did not include that element of sexual contact. If anything, he said, I admit to touching. That's not sexual contact. Most touching does not amount to sexual contact. He never said, I touched the testicle. Even if he did say, I touched the testicle, which he did not, he would have had to have that element of to sexually gratify. So when we look at Plastow tells us that in sufficiency of the evidence cases, a defendant may not be convicted unless the defendant's corroborated confession or admission, independent evidence of the crime, or a combination thereof establishes all elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Here, we have only this garbled, mixed up, back and forth statement. Now, we know things that DW said were not true. Things we know that he got absolutely wrong because of extraneous evidence. Number one, he testified with absolute certainty that he was so scared when Richter told him not to tell anyone that he did not disclose for 3 weeks. We know that's false because he disclosed on either the fourth or the fifth when those calls started.
Didn't trial counsel make those exact arguments to the jury?
Off the top of my head, I believe that they did, but again, I'm not trial counsel, but the jury was dealing with the prejudice of all of these other matters from issues 1, 2, and 3, the stuffed animal, the putting him in the smaller circle of people that this is more likely to have occurred. So we have to look at the prejudice when we're also looking at this.
But whether they were argued or not, we're prohibited, strictly prohibited, from reweighing the evidence in on appeal. We can't sort of say, yeah, you know, DW really wasn't strong on this part. And so for that reason, the jury could not have believed his testimony. We just simply can't do that.
I understand that this court can't go back and be the fact finder, but this court does, on a sufficiency of the evidence review, have to go back and has a duty to go back and see if the evidence amounted to beyond a reasonable doubt.
No, we don't reweigh beyond a reasonable doubt. Look for evidence that would constitute substantial evidence on an element. We are not reweighing for a burden of proof.
And I agree, Your Honor, but I would say that here we don't have the evidence on the elements to meet the beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, I would submit, when I was relooking at the standards of proof in preparation for this, I was reminded of the court statement on clear and convincing, the much lower standard of evidence, in which this court said that the witness must be credible and the facts to which they have testified must be distinctly remembered, the details thereof narrated exactly and in due order, and their testimony must be so clear, direct, and weighty and convincing as to enable either a judge or jury to come to a clear conviction.
What case is that?
That is in the matter of CDB, or excuse me, in the matter of adoption of CDB, 2005 SD 115, paragraph 15.
Thank you.
So it's difficult because going back and reviewing if the element of the crime is met does, in this case, include having to go back and see exactly what was said and whether that testimony, if believed, was sufficient. And again, I do believe that sufficiency of the evidence ties directly in this case with the prejudice, because it is more likely that the prejudice affected and we could have had the probability of a different outcome based on the lack of substantive evidence that was submitted here. Also, I want to touch on the child witness statute and why I think that's really important. Something that hasn't been brought up here is that the child witness statute actually doesn't extend to all children. You have to be under 16. It also doesn't extend to every crime. It extends to sexual cases, abuse cases, violent cases. So this court, if you don't find for the defense on this, then we would have a situation potentially where a 17-year-old could come in to testify about a petty theft second and bring a stuffed animal. And we say, oh, well, you know, the child statute doesn't allow for this at all. In fact, it appears that it was written so that it doesn't cover this, but the judge has broad discretion. It doesn't look like it's going to hurt anything. So let's go ahead and let him testify. No, the statute's put there so that we have these guidelines, so that we have these processes. In addition, the dog statute, and why that's important, is because it doesn't just say any disabled adult or a developmentally disabled or child can come in here with a therapy dog. There are orders and processes. There has to be a motion filed. There has to be a finding by the court that it's likely that that dog would alleviate anxiety. There has to be a relationship shown between the person and the therapy dog such that it could be beneficial. And there's a whole statute that says what the dog handler has to do. So with that, my time is up, and I would submit to the court that Richter has shown that there is insufficient evidence to sustain this verdict, and we would ask that you find that the errors are prejudicial and vacate his judgment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess till about 10.